Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is episode 200 of the Distraction Pieces podcast, which means there's been, you know, over 600 welcomes, because there's also been some bonus episodes and some two-parters and stuff like that, but there's a lot of welcomes, and I mean every one of them, because you are truly, truly welcome. Thank you for tuning in, guys. This week's guest is Jess Tom, and as soon as I confirmed her as a guest, I slotted it in as the 200th slot, because I think I knew it would be a conversation that deserves all the fanfare and excitement that comes around with, you know, a milestone anniversary. So it's a great chat, and I think you're going to really enjoy it. Before we get into it, obviously, man, it's been 200 episodes. That's mad. You lot are the best. When I started this, or still now, it's just me and my microphones and knocking about the country, just going and chatting to people. And it blows my mind that we've got up to 200 episodes. Every week you guys tune in. Over 12 million of you have downloaded episodes. So, yeah. Thank you very much. I'm going to spend a little 5-10 minutes now going over a few of the episodes. There's episodes that have had big names that most of you have probably listened to. You've probably all heard the Russell Brand one. And the Stuart Lee one is hugely downloaded, and the Simon Pegg one. But I'm going to go over a few that I think might have been missed or overlooked. So that's okay. On episode number 6, I had a guy called Simon Sing on, and it was a fantastic one about science and maths, and he bought an Enigma machine and showed me how that works. It was great. And on episode 8, I had Jodie Ann Bickley, who's an amazing a young lady and someone I love dearly, who, in effect, I felt in some way responsible for the fact that she nearly died. But we'll get into that in the chat. Episode 16, I had a young man on. I've been doing a bit of acting, a bit of rap, and he was doing good. His name's Riz Ahmed. If there's ever an argument for me having a guest back on, it's Riz, right? Because since then, The Night Of came out, and he won all these awards for it. He's in Star Wars. He's in the upcoming Venom film. It's a pretty amazing one. Obviously, I'm not going to go through all of them, guys. Relax. One guest that I have people request a lot to come on is Sarah Pascoe. And she was already on episode 28. I don't know why people seem to have missed it, but it was a great episode, and she's a great guest. So check that out. The Gail Porter episodes, I think the bulk of you have listened to, because they're kind of, the Gail Porter ones and the Eddie Temple Morris ones were kind of real standouts to a lot of you guys, because we got really into mental health in a way that hadn't been done much. I had Howard Marks on. Howard Marks isn't with us anymore, but damn, I got to chat with Howard Marks. The Killer Mike episode a while back was a cracker, but one of the ones that was the first to make me kind of realise the importance of these platforms was episode number 42, the Refugee Week's special with Ramel. To get to tell her story was absolutely overwhelming and wonderful. I feel I'm going to end up rambling forever now, so I'm going to jump forward, because there was a specific episode I was talking about online recently. I didn't really make a big deal out of it at the time, but this podcast was nominated for a humanitarian award. Like, I'm not even joking. That sounds mental if you've heard Drunk Casts or any of the other messy things that we've done. But I, episode number 86 was a safe housing for women's special, where a young lady called Mira. And yeah, it was a really special conversation, because it talked about sex trafficking. And Mira told her story in a very raw and, you know, uncomfortable manner. And in 2016, I got an email and letters and that from the Houses of Parliament to say that the Human Trafficking Foundation had nominated that episode for their Anti-Slavery Day Media Awards. I had to go to the Houses of Parliament And there was this award ceremony. I didn't make a big deal of it because we didn't end up winning. So, and it was all a bit weird and uncomfortable. I had to check really carefully that it was non-party specific, because I don't particularly support any of our current governmental system. But this was a really cool thing. So I went along. I felt uncomfortable in the Houses of Parliament when I hadn't won. I went on my own because, again, I felt uncomfortable and weird. When I hadn't won, I waited for a moment when everyone was having the drinks and all that to pretend to go to the toilet, and then I just snuck out and went and got a burger and got the train home. But yeah, that's an episode that's certainly worth a listen, I reckon. I mean, at the moment, I'm hiccuping and burping all over this one, so this isn't great. Let's do a few of the last 200, because I did a bit of a recap on the 100th episode. James Acaster was a great chat. He's recently had his Netflix special, Have Everyone Realise What a Genius He Is. He was on episode 104. Obviously, we've had... I don't want to just list the big ones of Limmy and Frankie Boyle and all these great ones. So let me look at ones. The Dignity in Dying special was really cool. Episode 121. That was an emotional roller coaster, to say the least. Of last year's ones, we did a really good pair of homeless specials on episode 135. And then the week after that is Wim Hof. And then the week after that, in fact, that might be one of my favourites ever, is episode 137 with Ancilla van der Leest. People ask me to talk about politics more. That one was 90% about politics and internet security, which is becoming all the more relevant with all this stuff on Facebook recently. So go in and check that out, episode 137 with Ancilla van der Leest, who, congratulations to her, who became, as she became a mum recently, which is fantastic. I should get on with a podcast. I love the Sophia Batella conversation. I loved all of them. Will Poulter was great. Suede McKennitt. I'm going to stop now because this is just the longest intro, and I know it's our 200th, but you're in for a long ride anyway with a conversation between someone with a stutter and someone with Tourette's. So let's just get into the podcast. We're brought to you as ever by Speech Development Records. A lot of you will hear that each week and not go and buy anything. This is the 200th episode, man. It's our birthday. So if you do have any spare income and you want to go over and invest it, then that'd be pretty cool. You know, speechdevelopmentrecords.com, we've got t-shirts, we've got my live DVD. That if you're into the podcast, into me talking, and my live DVD is just more of me talking, and that's a digital download option as well. So yeah, head over to speechdevelopmentrecords.com and have a browse. Maybe buy something as a little birthday 200th episode celebration treat. That'd be lovely. So yeah, let's get into episode 200 with Jess Tom. But I mean, it wasn't until I was researching this that I realised, and it felt quite profound to me, how parallel mine and Jess's neurological issues are, or how opposite, I guess, because I've grown up with a stutter, and we go into this a bit in the podcast. I grew up with a stutter, so I've grown up always having certain words or certain things that I want to say, but I literally can't get out my mouth. They get stuck. And Jess has lived her life with certain words and phrases that she's got no desire to say whatsoever, but she can't stop them getting out. And that felt like a beautiful choice for this 200th episode to sit down and put those two things together and it be listened to by thousands and thousands of people, not ignored or people feeling awkward because I can't get words out properly and Jess just won't shut up. It felt important that this was the 200th episode, because there's going to be thousands of you listening to this for the quality of what Jess has to say, the story that she has to tell, and in some part for, you know, the the 200 episodes of podcasts and reliability that I've popped out here stuttering my way through it. So, yeah, it meant a lot and it means a lot. So thank you guys for listening and tuning in. And this is episode 200 of the Distraction Pieces podcast. I've said this about 5 times now, with Jess Tom.
Knock it.
So
headbutt the mic.
What perfect way to begin with headbutt of the mic.
Headbutt the mic.
I'm here today with Jess Tom. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks.
It's great to have you on.
Biscuit.
I mean, already quite evident, I think, is biscuit. That I have a stutter and you biscuit. Have Tourette's.
Biscuit! So hedgehog, biscuit.
This is going to be a hell of an interaction, I think.
Biscuit. Communication diversity, motherfucker.
Exactly. All over it.
Sausage, all over your sheep.
There's a lot of stuff I want to talk about, but as we were starting, we were talking about plastic straws.
Yes, and, I've got a plastic straw in my drink.
You've got a plastic straw in your drink because your tics are physical and vocal. And a plastic straw is needed for drinking tea, or easier. It makes it a lot easier. And you were saying,
I mean, it doesn't make it a lot easier. It is essential. Otherwise, we would both be getting very wet right now.
Yeah, yeah.
Shower.
The kit would be covered.
You could showering tea.
Yeah, exactly. What a better way to go. But you were saying that you have done a post recently explaining why plastic straws specifically are needed for some people that have disabilities.
Yeah, biscuit. So yeah, some disabled people rely on straws. They're such a simple, basic thing, but actually there is the difference between being able to drink independently for some people and not being able to drink independently. Biscuit. There are obviously alternatives to plastic, and I use biodegradable plastic straws.
Yeah.
But I wrote about how sometimes things that might seem really unnecessary to one group of people are absolutely essential to another. And so I think it's really important that when we're campaigning or addressing anything within our society, including things, biscuit, that are really important for the environment, biscuit, like addressing our over-reliance on plastic, 100%. It is important to do that and think of different people's perspectives. Fuck it! Yeah. Biscuit, hedgehog, sausage.
It's nuanced, isn't it? It's nuanced, and it's something that we lack a lot. I talk about it too much on the podcast, but we lack a lot in this social media world that it's kind of all or nothing. It's like, no, we need to get rid of plastic straws. It's like,
biscuit.
All right, well, we need to get rid of the bulk of them, but there's reasons that they're handy, and a glass straw wouldn't be a good thing to have around for someone that has physical tics.
You wouldn't
paper
want
straws are going to be snappable and bendable and whatever else. So
I suppose for me, it's disabled people saying what they need really clearly and are often not being listened to, but loads of other alternatives being suggested.
Yeah,
and it's like I've explored lots of the alternatives, and as a disabled person, I know what I need.
Yeah.
It's important, I think, that when we an outright ban is probably going to do no one a good service. Yeah. It's much more sensible to think about changing our habits as a society, but doing so in a way, biscuit, that also considers difference. Yeah. I think often people don't deliberately exclude people, or biscuit, or deliberately create barriers. It's a lack of thought. And there's for me, inclusivity, biscuit, is really simple. It's the difference between, biscuit, assuming everyone does things the same way, biscuit, and understanding that people do things differently. As soon as you start planning and thinking about the fact that people need to do things in a different way, if you want to make your work or whatever your service accessible to people, you just have to be prepared to adapt.
The opinions and views of people that know what they're talking about. Mm. Again, it's fair to assume that if this is an essential, everyday part of your life, you're going to have thought about other options.
I mean, so I have thought about straws a lot.
Has never in their life thought, how would someone with a specific disability do this, to then think that they've on the spot come up with a solution that you wouldn't have thought of over months or years or whatever of trying to
Brian Solutions is is wonderfully arrogant, isn't he?
Biscuit. I mean, key to my understanding of my experiences as a disabled person, Biscuit is something called the social model of disability.
Yes.
Biscuit, and that is a way of thinking about disability, Biscuit, that gets away from Biscuit traditional sort of medical or charity Biscuit ways of thinking that see people as being disabled because their bodies or minds are impaired in some way, and so they're broken and in need of fixing or cure. Yeah. Biscuit, the social model of disability is brilliant because it says that people aren't disabled by their minds or bodies. It's normal to have bodies and minds that work in different ways. Biscuit, and for some people to have impairments and some people not. What is disabling, Biscuit, is a failure to consider difference within our society and how we set things up. Biscuit, I'm disabled by non-accessible environments. I'm disabled by systems like voice-operated telephone systems, Biscuit, that aren't configured for Biscuits.
Yeah,
those are the Biscuit and or disabling attitudes. Those are the things that make me a disabled person, Biscuit, not my tics. Biscuit.
Yeah.
Sausage!
Biscuit. I love that. That outlook and perception. Biscuit. You were on Richard Hedge. Herring's podcast.
Fuck it.
And
Biscuit.
I thought it was fantastic. Hedge. And
sausage.
One of the things that was said on that was he asked
Biscuit
if you would change your disability. And the answer you gave, I'm not going to make you just repeat Biscuit. That podcast, but the answer you gave was you'd change other people's perception Biscuit. And reaction to it, or the way society is to it. And that was great, because I Biscuit. Thought... For, as we'll get into all it, you're
Hedge.
A comedian and
sausage,
an
bus driver,
and theatre performer,
living statue,
and a sausage,
butcher,
a bus driver,
window cleaner,
a window Biscuit. Cleaner.
I'm now
statue.
Listing loads of jobs that would be incredibly dangerous for all of us. Sausage, I'm a knife axe.
You would be the worst a living statue ever. That would be wonderful.
Biscuit, hedgehog, Biscuit. Be my niche. My niche selling point would be that I am absolutely not a statue.
The absolute. Or for the brief moments you do stand Biscuit. Still in that way would be worth every penny they
Hedge
throw.
Biscuit.
But
Biscuit, will it Biscuit?
A lot of that is because of, a lot of that has come about, I guess, in a reaction to Biscuit. Your tics.
Yeah, Biscuit, Biscuit, I suppose going back to that point about that question that Richard asked, it's a very common question for people to say things like, you know, if there was a magic pill that you could take to, you know, to get rid of Tourette's tomorrow, would you take it? And I think that, for me, all of those questions miss the point. Mm. I'm not interested in just changing my experience or Biscuit, and I'm not interested in changing my body. It's the way it is. I love it. I think it's great. It can be frustrating at times, and there are challenges, but it also, Biscuit, gives me access, Biscuit, to a spontaneous creativity that I don't think I'd have otherwise. I'm not interested in changing the way my brain works, but I am very interested in changing the sort of disabling barriers that exist in our world.
Yeah,
and nobody ever asks, people are much more likely to ask, would you like to be fixed, rather than what can we do to make the world better and work for more people. And that's what I'm interested in, because there's no point in just, fixing things isn't the way. Like, what we need to fix is the barriers that exist in our society.
And it's not...
Ramble! I'm rambling. Hello, I'm rambling.
and fixing is a ludicrous term anyway, because it's all
fuck.
On perspective. The fact is, the beauty of comedy and so many kinds of performance Petrus. Is the removing of boundaries, the removing of boundaries in your own mind.
Yeah.
You've kind of had that thrust upon you in many ways. So
Petrus.
Your comedy will rather than avoid or awkwardly move around
Biscuit.
Your tics, it will openly embrace it and openly allow people to laugh
sausage.
At them and enjoy
fuck it.
Enjoy that part of it.
Yeah, Biscuit, well, there's not much other choice, do you know what I mean? Biscuit, I think I often say that I'm quite lucky because I have tics, Biscuit, that are quite noticeable.
Yeah.
It means that I don't have to do that thing where I worry about when I'm going to tell someone that I have Tourette's and worry about their response. It's something, Biscuit, that I can acknowledge straight away and then just get on with whatever I'm doing. But definitely, like, in my performance work, Biscuit, I have to allow space for tics. There's no point in pretending that they're not happening. Biscuit, that would just be, Biscuit, really fucking weird. Biscuit, weird. Weird, Biscuit, weirder than Harold Shipman on a donkey.
Easily.
Okay, probably try and avoid serial killers. Serial killers! the cocoa pox have died. Biscuit.
Tourette's is something that I think is largely
sausage.
Not understood in in the general public when I was at school. I'm more of a dog man, but
I don't love cats. I think it's important to acknowledge. Biscuit, that was absolutely a tip that I say all the time. I don't love cats. I don't hate cats, Biscuit. I am, in fact, indifferent to cats. Fuck it. I love cats.
So when I was at school, there was a documentary or two that come out that was the first time that people had kind of seen Tourette's. And to school kids, it was like this cool, exciting thing because it's swearing. All it was known in that one was that it's uncontrollable swearing, and swearing for kids is exciting. So an excuse to get to do that is
duck fart.
Is wonderful. Duck fart, that's
that one I like. Sausage.
What do you understand of Tourette's from a medical point of view? Because I asked that in that way because I've got a stutter and people often ask me, and I don't understand it at all. It's a weird thing in the brain. It's not like I'm not a neurologist. I'm someone who's got a stutter, so I know it happens. I know it came from a traumatic event when I was four, almost drowned. But other than that, I don't know. So what's your kind of understanding of Tourette's and how would you explain it clearer?
So Tourette's is a neurological condition, Biscuit, which means that it's a brain condition, Biscuit. It's on a spectrum, so Biscuit affects each person differently, and some people's tics will be barely noticeable. Biscuit, like mine, not like mine, while others will behave in a way that makes them stand out. Biscuit, everybody with Tourette's will have at least one vocal tic and multiple motor tics, so involuntary movements, and they'll have had those for more than a year. Biscuit, only 10% Biscuit of people with Tourette's have corporalia, Biscuit, which is the technical Biscuit name for obscene tics. Biscuit, so 90% of people with Tourette's don't have any swearing tics. Biscuit, it is one of the big myths, Biscuit, about the condition, Biscuit. And my understanding of the sort of medical side of it, or the science side of it, is that it's an area of the brain, Biscuit, called the basal ganglia. But that is about the extent of my extent of my knowledge. Biscuit, what I can say is that, Biscuit, for me, it's like, it's not caused by nervousness or bad parenting, Biscuit, or demonic possession. Biscuit, hedgehog, cats, sausage, I think, Biscuit, any heightened emotion, Biscuit, can exacerbate my tics. So if I'm really excited or really frustrated, Biscuit, or watching any film that involves mild peril, Biscuit, hedgehog, then my tics might, Biscuit, hedgehog, be like slightly more intense. But it can also, they go up and down and change for absolutely no reason. Biscuit, and why certain words stick around is also a mystery. So Biscuit, lots of people will ask me, Biscuit, why Biscuit? Biscuit, and I definitely haven't had any traumatic experiences with biscuits.
No.
Hedgehog, with Biscuit, I was masturbated by a jam roly-poly. I mean, I wasn't. A sausage.
It's unimaginable.
It'd be messy. So fuck! Jam.
How kind of...
Welcome to Jam Rock.
How regularly do
sausage.
Your specific or your regular tics kind of variate? As Biscuit, I know Biscuit, Hedgehog, and Sausage.
Biscuit, Sausage.
Three that are regular.
Biscuit, so Biscuit, I often describe sort of vocal tics as there being sort of three types of vocal tic, and this is very much just about my experience of them. There's the regular tics, Biscuit, that I say hundreds of times a day.
That's fine.
Hedgehog, noisy. Biscuit, we're in an airport. we're in a cheese board factory. Okay, we're just in a room. Biscuit, so there's very regular tics that Biscuit I'll say hundreds of times a day, like Biscuit and Hedgehog and cats at the moment. Biscuit, there are occasional tics that I might just say once or twice and then they might never come up again. Sometimes they might be really simple, and sometimes they can be really complex. Biscuit, Hedgehog, Biscuit, because tics can be just a sniff or a squeak, or they can be words and phrases. Biscuit, and the final type of tic are like tics that are almost explosive in how they come out, and it'll be a big burst of themed tics.
Yeah.
So sometimes things on a particular theme will all come out together. Biscuit, and tics can be like influenced by the environment around me. Biscuit, but it's definitely not just what I'm thinking. Biscuit, I'm thinking about you rolled up in cotton sheep.
I'm going to be cotton thinking about sheep. That constantly now. It's a fascinating one, because the last one where it's kind of influenced by your surroundings, when I came to see your performance of Not I, you explained that you had to be kind of very much secured, because, and we'll get into that in great detail as we go on, but you had to be raised for it, and you have a wheelchair and heights and a wheelchair part of you. Like having physical tics, there's a risk that you would throw yourself off a stage or a ramp. So
I mean, there's not just a chance, there's a high likelihood.
You're doing that show every night for several weeks. There's going to be a lot of injuries on both sides of the performance.
Biscuit, it would be a very short play if I wasn't strapped in. Biscuit, for some people with Tourette's, there's an element of doing or saying, Biscuit, the worst thing in any given situation.
Yeah.
So for me, Biscuit, that impulsivity and that lack of impulse control, Biscuit means I'm very good at knowing what's dangerous. I've got a really good sense of danger. Biscuit, what I haven't got is the bit in my brain that stops me from then acting on that dangerous thing. So I think everybody, when coming close to an edge of a building or a road, would think, a height, would think, I mustn't jump or I mustn't walk in front of walk into the road. Biscuit, my brain has that same thought, but then does the opposite. So it means that I'll see something hot and be like, oh, that's hot, you shouldn't touch it. And automatically my arm will reach out and touch it. And so, if I'm up 8 feet in the air, Biscuit, and have an option of not being Biscuit, chances are I'll throw myself down. Biscuit. And so that impulsive and oppositional side of Tourette's, Biscuit, is probably one of the, something that lots of people wouldn't know about, Biscuit, but is one of the things that on a daily basis requires quite a lot of attention to keep me safe and to keep, other people who have a similar experience safe.
Yeah, of
Biscuit.
Course.
Sausage!
Is it something that's... How is it when you're Biscuit. On your own? Is it heightened by being around people? You spoke in...
Sausage!
In after the show about the peace at times of going... when you are out of going into the toilets to be able to tick freely. And it's something that I've definitely experienced in life. I've realised over years that one of the reasons I'm a bit of a recluse is because that time on my own in silence, I'm not having to fight a stutter. And it's something that is a second nature thing now, but it's still
it
can be an exhausting thing. So do you find it more relaxing when you're on your own, or is it still kind of...
Biscuit, my body and my tics keep going when I'm on my own. Biscuit, I used to find that actually quite challenging. Biscuit, there's something about ticking on my own, Biscuit, that as my tics were intensifying, I found quite confronting. Biscuit, because when there are other people around, there's the context of them, people laughing or people enjoying them or being around. Like, it feels within the context of normal conversation. And so perhaps, particularly with close friends and family, it's like where I feel totally comfortable, and that's what everybody understands. Biscuit, being on your own means that there isn't that context, and Biscuit, you are with your own tics. Yeah. So for me, I'd be relaxed. It didn't make a difference to them, Biscuit. Yeah. But I did at the beginning find that quite hard. I had tics since I was about six, Biscuit, but they intensified in my early 20s, Biscuit, and began to have a bigger impact on my life. Biscuit, I think, Biscuit, what's nice, I suppose, about being in your own is that there are lots of, I feel like I'm very aware in public space about how people are responding to me.
Yeah.
Maybe less so now, Biscuit, as a wheelchair user, I think, because there is a visible symbol of disability that people recognise, Biscuit, I'm more likely to be treated with empathy and support, Biscuit, than when I was walking around. Even though my tics haven't changed at all, Biscuit, I'm also much more likely to be patronised and not spoken to directly, Biscuit. But definitely, I think when I was walking around, Biscuit, and very erratically, I think I was met with a lot of fear. People were often frightened of me and unsure on how to respond.
It's strange, isn't it, that switch from
cat.
Empathy or sympathy, even
Biscuit,
from almost hedgehog. Threat or again, they both come from misunderstanding hedgehog. And lack of knowledge.
Biscuit.
Yet they come out in completely different ways. If you see more
sausage.
If you can walk around and more in that, whereas if you're in a wheelchair, there is that great kind of
Biscuit.
Awareness
Biscuit.
Of a disability of some sort.
Yeah, I mean, Biscuit, that idea of what disability looks like, Biscuit, is something that really urgently, Biscuit, needs to change for us as a society. I don't think it serves anyone I think there's such a restricted view of what disability looks like and what that includes. And I think there's the perception of it, I think, for some people that it's sort of a club in some way. And you can't, you know, lots of people, I think, who will have particular impairments will say, oh, I don't know whether I can say that I'm disabled.
Right.
And for me, it's like, disability, because I understand that in the relation to the social model, it's like, if you have a body or mind, biscuit, that means that you experience barriers in the world because people haven't thought about you, biscuit, you can choose to identify as disabled if you wish. Disability is that shared experience of barriers because of how your body or mind works. For me, biscuit, saying I'm a disabled person makes me feel strong. It means it's part, means biscuit, those barriers are acknowledged, and only if they are acknowledged can they be changed. And so it doesn't do anyone any favours to say, oh, you know, I don't see you as disabled. It's like, I want you to see the barriers that I face, and I want you to understand them because I want us to be able to remove them together.
Yeah.
Biscuit, cat.
It's fascinating because, again, it is. It's weird that
the
term disabled, or the category of disabled, has gradually become something that is somehow governed and signed off on by the government or by the councils and things like that. And again, it's that kind of, well, but how disabled are you? So that's the weirdest question in the world, but it's a question that people with disabilities, number one, are constantly asked, and number two, are constantly made to ask of themselves, which is horrendous.
The thing is that for me, like, disability isn't a constant, unchanging state.
Yeah.
I am more or less disabled in different contexts. Biscuit, you know, in a room that's sort of flat and has loads of, you know, has, you know, where I can wheel around easily and where there are people who are really understanding of my tics and ready to help me and I have the right support, I can be totally independent and in control of my decision making.
Yeah.
You take some of those things away, take away my support or biscuit, or create an environment that's non-accessible, and then I'm disabled, then I'm restricted and isolated. So, but I think that responsibility for taking an inclusive biscuit approach is something that everybody shares and something that everybody can do, is be ready to adapt and do things in different ways for people as they need them. Biscuit, and just having a broader understanding of what disability might look or sound like, and it not, you know, if being ready to offer support without having to see a cane or a crutch or a pair of wheels. Sausage!
Sure. So biscuit. The urge to see change
sausage
in the way environments are set up for more and more people, was that something that motivated you to go into theatre and comedy and to take the stage as such, to change the environments that we currently have?
My journey to performance, I think, was probably quite an unusual one, biscuit, in that I had, you know, I had no ambitions, biscuit, for that to be part of my life. I am a creative person, and creative work has always been a big part of who I am, biscuit, but performance wasn't. And I, you know, biscuit, I worked on London's adventure playgrounds for the last sort of 20 years and sort of managing children's projects was what I had done professionally. But I created Tourette's Zero in 2010 as a response to my experiences living with the condition, and co-founded it with Matthew Pantley, who's a good friend and collaborator. Biscuit, hedgehog, cats, biscuit, beans. My short-term memory is appalling, biscuit, and I can't remember where I was going. Can you just remind me? Can you remind me very quickly?
Onto stage.
Route onto the stage, biscuit. Yeah, biscuit. So, biscuit, I co-founded Tourette's Zero in 2010, biscuit, as a creative response to my tics. And biscuit, what was slowly by, you know, through training, and it became clear that developing the language to talk about my tics was really positive and was making a big difference to me. And really, the move into theatre came because I was having lots of theatre was something that I wanted to see. I loved going to see comedy, but as my tics made me stand out, I found it harder and harder to go. And I had a few really difficult experiences at the theatre, biscuit, where I, you know, biscuit, despite doing loads of thinking and being in touch with the comedian beforehand, and you know, and the theatre and him introducing me to the whole audience, despite all of that preparation, I was still asked to, biscuit, move and sit separately. And it was a deeply upsetting and distressing experience. And in that moment, I promised myself, biscuit, that I would never set foot in another theatre again. Biscuit. But thankfully, it wasn't a promise I kept. And instead, I decided to occupy Biscuit, the only seat in the house, Biscuit that I wouldn't be asked to leave, Biscuit, on stage, and make a show that talked about my experiences of theatre and of Tourette's and of my passionately and deeply held belief, Biscuit, that if you make work, artwork, inclusive, you make it better.
Yeah.
You strengthen it. Sausage, Biscuit. So that was my route into performing. But I absolutely don't think you should have to make a show to feel safe in the theatre. And that's ultimately what I had to do, because I often felt unsafe in those cultural spaces. And I think, Biscuit, I had an interesting experience at a comedy event in Edinburgh, where the comedian, I hadn't had a chance to speak to him in advance, so I was there and with Tourette's in his audience, and I explained that when he noticed my tics. And he said something really interesting. He said, as a comedian, you plan for everything. You plan for hecklers, you plan for drunk people, but you wouldn't plan for someone with Tourette's. Biscuit, and my question to that is, why not?
Yeah.
Like, Biscuit, if we're expecting our audiences to not include people with learning disabilities or people with neurological conditions, then why are we assuming that those people aren't in our audiences?
Yeah,
Biscuit, Tourette's isn't a rare condition. It's estimated to affect 300,000 people in the UK alone, Biscuit. And obviously it's not the only neurological condition, Biscuit, that means you'll make, noise and movement. And so we're talking about, big swathes of the population, and it's like 1 in 5 people identify as disabled, but that's definitely not representative of who we see on stage or on screen. And Biscuit, that visibility of difference feels really important to me, because it was through seeing Biscuit the work of other disabled artists that gave me the confidence to start Tourette's Hero.
Yeah. Biscuit. And it's a fascinating one, because that choice that comedians in general.
Biscuit.
Because again, it's a weird one, because you can understand how for certain shows, if they're not prepared for it, it is going to be a tough thing for a comedian to deal with. It's going to be challenging. But as you've highlighted there, they will all prepare essentially for arseholes. They'll prepare for people who are going to heckle or be drunk or be offensive. But they won't prepare for people who completely involuntary are just there to enjoy themselves. It's like, why would you? You're doing it wrong. Amends for the wrong crowd there.
It is different, because like the thing about what makes Tourette's different from heckling is that I don't get to choose, but also it doesn't stop. Like, you start engaging with my tics and it will carry. Like, Tourette's will always have the last word, and I have no sort of control or agency over that, really. And so it's very difficult if somebody starts engaging with my tics in a particular way to then And actually, there have been a number of times in sort of comedy settings where there is that experience of becoming the show rather than just being able to watch the show. And I think, Biscuit, of course, it's, being on stage, I know as a comedian how challenging it is if people are shouting out.
Yeah.
But I suppose it's the same thing as talking about, like, visible symbols of disability. It's just thinking, right, people need to do things in a different way. Attention and focus looks different for different types of people. Biscuit, if I'm being still or quiet, then Biscuit, I mean, I'm either dead or I'm definitely not concentrating on what you're saying, Biscuit, because I have to put so much energy, Biscuit, into making my body still or quiet. Biscuit, like, it's possible, but only for very short periods of time.
Yeah.
But if I'm moving around, that means Biscuit and making repetitive noises.
Yeah.
I can be totally focused on what you're saying. Sausage.
That you're drawn in and engaged in their show.
Beans!
It's a fascinating one then, because when I came to see
Mother Teresa fucked a golf buggy in the 1950s.
I came to see that, but also when I came to see your performance of Not I, it was fascinating, because there was an information sheet beforehand that explained that it's an all-inclusive and welcoming situation and setting. If people wish to leave at any point, they can. If they wish to move around, they can.
Sausage.
There would be a kind of introduction beforehand, then there would be the main performance, then a short film about how it all came together, and then kind of an interaction and Q&A. And that seemed like a really simple way of making things inclusive, of saying, here's kind of the settings. I had Sophie Hagen on a while ago, who does her tours, as you can contact her in advance if you've got any specific needs or anything else, and it can be taken into account. Because, again, it's simple measures to eliminate the...
Yeah.
Caught off guard by something. But what then blew me away was the...
Hair
intensity of the performance and of the show. What I'd read on paper, in my mind, it was going to be this very, and quite wrongly, it was going to be this very laid back thing, and it'll probably stop at points and we'll all laugh and it'll be all let's continue on. And it wasn't that at all. The actual performance was one of the most intense and intricate things I've ever seen. So how was it going about putting that a show together? What made you choose Samuel Beckett? I always pause thinking I'm getting his name wrong because I'm a big fan of Quantum Leap.
Yeah.
And the main guy in Quantum Leap was Sam Beckett. Yeah. So I not many people. Samuel, is it? It's Sam. But so what drew you to that piece and then to put in the whole show together, I guess?
Hedgehog Biscuit. So the first show that we made, Biscuit, was called Backstage of Biscuitland. Biscuit. Yeah. And that was definitely like a warm, joyful comedy Biscuit that allowed lots of space for my tics and for them to take us off track, and it was a show that definitely had serious moments, but was very much about laughing and the power of humour. Biscuit, and when we were like Biscuit, we took that to Edinburgh in 2014, and we did that. It was the first show we'd made, and we took it up to the Fringe because we wanted to take it to people who made theatre and went to see theatre, and to directors and producers and performers. Because we felt that the message within the show about inclusivity and about the concept of relaxed performances, relaxed performances is a growing movement within UK theatre, Biscuit, for shows that take a relaxed approach to sound and movement coming from the audience and allow people to come and go and basically extend a really warm invitation to people who might find it difficult to follow the traditions of theatre etiquette.
Sure.
And so we took that show to Edinburgh, and it did unexpectedly did really well, and we got amazingly we got to tour across the UK and internationally, Biscuit. And while we were touring, Biscuit, lots of theatres and venues said things like, Biscuit, we're really excited about relaxed performance, and we'd love to make our work accessible to disabled people, but we just haven't had the right show yet, Biscuit. And I became fascinated by this idea of the cultural curation that happens around what work is and isn't considered suitable for disabled people. Biscuit, why the Lion King, but not Samuel Beckett?
And who's making those decisions?
Yeah, and on what? And often I think those decisions are built on assumptions. So I also had venues saying things like, "Oh, that show could never be a relaxed performance because it contains nudity." Yeah. Well, it's like, Biscuit, I can definitely cope with nudity. Yeah. Biscuits, fucking sheep, sausage dog. So we really wanted to extend Biscuit what the type of work that was considered suitable for relaxed performance. Yeah. We wanted to challenge people to think about who gets to perform what and how. Yeah. Biscuit, but Not I is a short play by the writer Samuel Beckett.
Yeah.
And
Biscuit, who's also a time traveller.
Yeah. Biscuit, my best mate Laura, when I said that we were doing a Sam Beckett play, was like really genuinely excited that I might be doing Quantum Leap. Maybe that's next. Hedgehog, cat, sausage. But Not I as a play had been a reference for me, actually, long before Tourette's Hero. Again, Matthew had introduced that play to me at a time when my tics were intensifying and I was finding it hard to adjust, Biscuit, and hard to recognise them as part of my body and part of my brain. Like I used to talk about the tics and the Tourette's rather than my tics.
Right, yeah.
And actually, the whole premise of the play, Not I, is that there's this disembodied mouth in a darkened room just going at it, like just giving a really fast, like monologue of broken up bits of someone's life experience.
And really hard to follow.
Really, and really hard to follow, both because the text is really broken and there is a story in there, but it's really fragmented, and because it's really fast, you have to do it super quick. And so for those, both those reasons, like, the experience of watching it is very different from the experience of reading it. And if you watch it, it's all about that being overwhelmed by language and sort of and rhythms and the sort of broken language, whereas if you read it, there are, you can follow these, this woman's experiences, like a woman in her 70s talking about lots of barriers that she's encountered in her life. And when I read it, I was blown away, because like line after line, Biscuit really resonated with my lived experience of Tourette's. And I'm not saying that this is a play about Tourette's, Biscuit, but it totally speaks to the experience of being neurodiverse and having a brain that works in an unusual way, or like in a way that's like non-normative.
And that for me is what made it such a powerful and unique theatre experience, because in general in theatre, you're trying to forget the performer. You're wanting to be lost completely in the character and this and that, but the relation between you, your life as the performer, and the character and the word being said, just all added an extra angle to it, which I found absolutely fascinating and kind of exciting and engaging. On the bits where you can pick this bit up, but the speed of it means that as soon as you're like, oh, that makes me think of this and this, and then you're like, there's been another 2 minutes. So it's kind of, it's a hell of a physical experience as an audience member, which...
Biscuit.
It's got to be a good thing.
Biscuit, basically, we wanted to demonstrate how you could make an intense theatrical Biscuit experience accessible to both performer and artist. Biscuit to both performer and audience. Biscuit without Biscuit reducing the intensity of the piece. And to really challenge and extend the idea about the type of work that you can make accessible, and to demonstrate how you can embed... like access considerations within a piece of work. So we have embedded audio description where possible, so to describe to people who can't see what's happening on stage or what people look like, Biscuit, or integrated sign language. So my co-performer is Charmaine Womwell, who is an amazing performer and whose first language is British Sign Language. Hedgehog, Biscuit, and all our performances are relaxed. Biscuit, which means that people can make noise and move around, Biscuit, and it feels really important to create spaces that demonstrate the benefits of inclusivity. And I was really interested in mixing audiences up and using Not I as a way to start conversations about different types of experience, and most importantly, claim that character as a disabled character and say that we don't need to wait for amazing parts, Biscuit, to be written for disabled performers. We just have to go and start finding them and claiming them and using broader stories to present different types of lived experience.
This is the point, and you will have noticed I've started looking at my notes, but it's because on the night I was so excited, I was making frantic notes, and one of the things I liked was immediately after the performance you gave a 10-minute moment where we... as an audience, we turned to the person next to us and discussed what we thought. And that was quite terrifying because I hadn't had 5-10 minutes to come up with my intelligent opinion yet. And you want to come across this, but you look so you're literally... my first thing was saying to the guy, I was like, yo, that was mad, wasn't it? I was like, I'll have some intelligent stuff to say any minute now. But it was really nice to go through those... through that experience with a stranger and say, here's what I thought. Oh, I hadn't thought of that. And that, again, it became part of the performance and part of what was delivered on the night.
Sausage.
That made it different from an often exclusionary theatre performance where I've gone to see stuff that I've loved. I've also gone to see stuff I've not understood at all. And I'll just not mention that and I'll go on with my life. But it was nice to kind of talk about the bits I didn't get, the bits I got distracted during, because I suddenly started thinking what other amazing pieces could be given a completely new perspective by being performed by someone who has a Tourette's. I'd gone in thinking, as they've kind of said, what almost from that
sausage.
That outside biscuit. Onlooker of what things would be appropriate.
Yeah.
Or what things would someone would be capable of performing. Whereas biscuit. It ended, I was like, what things could be transformed by this amazing, unique perspective. So, yeah, it was an exciting experience to have that interaction at the end.
Biscuit. Well, I think it also, like, so for me, I very rarely see my experiences as a disabled person represented on screen or TV in a way that feels resonant. Like where you see wheelchair users or disabled people, particularly in films, they are often characters that are written and performed by non-disabled people. So all of those stereotypes about, you know, what it means to be a disabled person are often rehashed by people who don't have that as part of their lived experience. And I think that that's damaging because it means that not only are stereotypes being reinforced, but also disabled performers aren't being nurtured. And I think what people often focus on how difficult it would be for a particular performer to undertake roles. And actually, it's like if you look at it the other way around, it can be totally transformative and they bring a lived experience. I think often people say, oh, you know, it's just acting. So if people are sort of crip up, so that's cripping up is the practice of non-disabled people taking on disabled roles, they will often only focus, that's mimicking the physical symptoms of a particular condition.
Yeah.
That's, being disabled is so much more than that. It's about, let's get that experience, a bit of that lived experience of disability is definitely part of my identity. Like experiencing those barriers and on a daily basis has shaped me and my outlook on the world. And I think any disabled performer taking on a role would obviously take on that role and concentrating on acting that character. But those elements of what it means to be a disabled person would be understood in a much deeper way. Yeah. And I think I just get so frustrated. I watched something last night where there was a wheelchair using character played by a non-wheelchair using actor. And it was like all of the stuff like focused on him pissing at the dinner table and things like that into a bottle. And I was like, I wish I could do that. Way more complicated than that.
Yeah.
But that like obsession with like how disabled people go to the toilet or how they have sex or that idea that of course he can be a horrible character because he's a wheelchair user. You know, if you're a wheelchair user, your life must be so depressing that you'd have to be absolutely horrendous to everybody around you. And it's like there's loads of those really like cliched and represent like views, and it just turns me off stuff. It's like it's so much richer if you get someone who has that as part of their lived experience,
because they can give a character to the disability rather than the disability being the character, which is so often the case in things. One of the notes I made,
sausage,
was the build-up of biscuits. Which is a hell of a note, but it's something that added an intensity to the piece, because again, as you've said, it's a very quickly a delivered piece. Coming from a rap background myself, it was amazing to see the use of delivery, of syllable placement, of breathing. But it meant that when there was a gap, and often a written pause in the text, there was then a build-up of biscuits, that would then come out. And that kind of added intensity, because it felt like there was this pressure to get this out, and then this explosion.
What I didn't know until we started performing it as a whole piece, because it's really hard to learn and takes a long time because it's so broken and doesn't follow a normal sort of narrative that you can follow in your head. It's very repetitive, and it's so easy to end up getting taken down a wormhole and being totally lost in the words.
What point am I at?
Yeah. It's terrifying. Biscuit. Hedgehog. Cats. The biscuit. Short-term memory.
Yeah. Oh, we're on the build-up of biscuits. In the gaps, in the pauses, the...
Yeah, biscuit. So I didn't realise until I started performing it as a whole text that there are these four moments of pause that Samuel Beckett has written into the play. And in those moments, it was like every biscuit that would have been in the section before, yes, sort of pistoned out at top speed. And I hadn't, I wasn't deliberately suppressing those ticks and biscuit, but there was an almost automatic suppression that happened, putting biscuit, putting that monologue, putting those words through my body and through my mouth. Biscuit somehow displaced some of my vocal tics. I think it made my motor tics move about more, made my body move about more. But I often describe it as like putting a stone into water, putting that monologue through my body, displaced and moved some of the tics, vocal tics, out of the way. But as soon as there were those gaps, those moments of pause, they all flowed through like if you'd taken the stone out. And fuck, those moments were some of the most challenging for me in performing it, because not that there I got thrown by the biscuits, but because the stream became so forceful that actually knowing how, working out how I could break into that, break into my own involuntary language to go back into the text and do the next bit of performance was like really hard, like really scary, because it's like you have to, how am I going to break back into all those biscuits and be able to breathe at the same time?
It must have been exhausting. It must have been exhausting as well, because you're breaking a very intense bit of delivery that's tick-based with an intense bit of delivery that's not tick-based. So it's like you're a full sprint and you have to then turn a full right turn, but keep sprinting. It's not to stop. You've got to do a complete right angle turn and keep going at that pace. So
biscuit.
How was that as a physical thing to get used to the exhaustion of delivering?
Yeah, biscuit. Well, the biscuit. The good thing about Not I is that it is very intense, but it's also very short, biscuit. Yes. So in my mind, I'd be like, "Come on, Jess, you just got to do this for 12 minutes." It's biscuit. And that bit of the, as you said, it's like that 12 minutes fits into a bigger part of the show, which is a biscuit, an hour, and I was always found that sort of the Beckett, the Not I bit, the most scary bit. And it's interesting, Charmaine, who is the BSL performer, she found the Beckett bit the most straightforward bit, and would worry and be more anxious about some of the discussion because she didn't know what people were going to say. Biscuit, and so it's interesting that we both had these bits that we worried about, but they were different.
It was amazing to see the challenges for Charmaine as well, though, because, again, the way that you did it beautifully was you wanted her to sign all of the ticks as well. And when I had a radio show on XFM, it was pre-recorded, I had a producer, and one of the first meetings we had, I had to say, look,
biscuit,
leave all the stutters in, otherwise you're going to have far much more work than this is worth. It's only an hour show. If it takes you 5 hours to cut it into the shape, it's not worth it. But one of the things that made that fascinating is my mum does BSL, and it's something I've grown up around a bit. So I'm aware that a lot of people aren't aware that it's not a straight translation. The structures are different, the terms are different. And the way Charmaine described it on the night was, if it's a man is on a mountain, then she'll build the mountain first and then put the man on top. So in our sentence, the man is first. So it's tough if she started building the mountain and then a biscuit comes in halfway through the building of the mountain. So she has to strip the mountain back down and give the biscuit, then rebuild the mountain. Yeah. So that must have been a fascinating challenge on that side. It's not as simple as she's learnt Not I in BSL.
Biscuit.
It's not as simple as that. She's then got to translate it kind of
like... I think if she'd just had to learn it and perform it, then it would have been a very different experience.
But it was
her.
A combination of the two as well, because she had to deliver it at speed, so she had to know it, but it was then having to put her own brakes on and go, oh, at least you... Well, no, I guess you don't. I was going to say, at least you know the ticks are coming, but you don't.
But what I do know is, my sort of thoughts are totally tick free. So my performance, I just concentrate on doing the performance. She describes it as having to have this peripheral listening. So she does know the text and she knows what's coming up, but she doesn't know where the biscuits are going to be. So she has to listen out for them. I think it's very easy. Biscuit, most people will also automatically tune them out. Biscuit, people who know me well or spend a lot of time with me. Biscuit, I think, at the beginning, you might notice every single biscuit, but quickly you learn to edit them out. Biscuit. Completely. Charmaine couldn't allow that editing out process to happen.
Yes, of course.
She had to keep her attention on them, Biscuit. And that's the reason why it needed to be a hearing performer rather than a deaf performer, because, my, you know, if there wasn't that requirement, then that role should definitely have been a deaf person,
yeah,
a deaf artist. Yeah. But we needed that translation. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And we do a thing on the highlights of the podcast. We take a small section and make a little video of it. And I really want to take
video
the sentence that you just said, where
Biscuit,
as she knows the text, as she knows the words that come in next, but she doesn't know where the biscuits are going to
be.
Because it's out of context. There was no ticks in it, so it's out of context. That would just confuse people hugely as a sentence.
There's a biscuit over there. So, 14 biscuits and a jammy dodger.
So you studied and looked at rap as a way of getting your delivery down for this. I've had a Carla on the show previously, and on the video before, and you showed a bit of a Carla. How was that as a thing to kind of... Is that's something that you expected to be drawing from for a performance of a Samuel Beckett of a theatre piece?
Biscuit, I mean, I don't think I had any preconceptions about what we would be drawing on as references. Biscuit, hip-hop, grime, those are musical references that are meaningful for me anyway. That's the type of music that I, Biscuit, enjoy listening to. But it felt totally relevant, Biscuit, to this piece, not just because of the speed of delivery needed and the clarity of articulation, which is amazing in loads of hip-hop and grime artists. It's incredible how they sort of deliver really complex lines at such breakneck speed. Yeah. Biscuit. And so there's definitely that link, Biscuit. But I think there's also a link politically, you know, the roots of hip-hop, Biscuit, and as sort of communication and giving voice to Biscuit, to lived experience, and the urgency of that communication, Biscuit, definitely is something that also felt relevant to this piece and to Mouth and to my life as a disabled person, because it feels urgent at the moment to communicate what is happening to disabled people. And so many people are being written out of our society by cuts to services and to vital equalising schemes. We're looking at a generation of young disabled people who are seeing, Biscuit, barriers in their life increase rather than decrease because of things that the things that we are prioritizing as a society, Biscuit. Yeah. And so that urgent need to tell and to give voice to that experience is something that I definitely feel, Biscuit. And I think there is that link with the history of that music.
A parallel there. And something I found interesting as well was when I started to have music get out there, rap in itself, as you said, it's quite quick delivery. So
sausage.
If you speak English, you've got a comfort and relaxation that you'll probably miss a lot of what's being said because you already understand it. And I found that when I went and gigged in Europe, people understood the lyrics that bit more. Because they didn't understand it, they'd look and pay attention and read. And that's something I felt that came in this performance as well, because of the ticks and because of the awareness of what this performance is. It meant, I think, that you zoned in that bit sharper to catch bits. If it wasn't, if it was another performance, you may have just had that relaxation of just of loads of it going over your head. So it's kind of an interesting one that it draws. Rather than the ticks distracting you, they draw greater attention to the text. That's what I'm trying to
Biscuit, and there's very tick-like language in that text, like sudden flash. It's repeated over and over again. And actually, at points when I first started learning it, lots of the language of the play started coming out as involuntary ticks.
Yeah.
And that was at a time we were touring backstage in Biscuitland. I was like, I can't mix these two shows up because they're very different superficially. Cats, Biscuit, Hedgehog, I definitely had something to say, but I can't remember what it was.
You talked about the visual, and that was one of the most striking and amazing things. Again, considering in my head I was walking into this very relaxed thing, the notes in the play that the performer is kind of strapped up and raised in the air, and there's a spotlight on their mouth, and that obviously wasn't an option with your disabilities. So the way it was performed, it has to be a disembodied mouth, and you were raised up with kind of a hat on of sorts, that
a hoodie
that put a light only on your mouth.
Yeah.
How was that to come up with all of that and to battle to get the right to do the performance? Because again, it is a piece, and the Beckett Society are quite restrictive on when they allow these things to be formed and what rules are twisted and bent.
So the Beckett Estate are control the rights to Not I and to perform Not I. So. Yeah. That's the family estate of Samuel Beckett. They choose and get to work. They get to select when the play is performed and who by and how. Biscuit, they have a reputation for being very sort of strict about following the stage directions, Biscuit, and clear about wanting the work, any of Samuel Beckett's work, performed in the way that he had intended, Biscuit. Yeah. So actually, lots one of the other things, I suppose, that meant that we went for this play, aside from it being a reference for a long time and it feeling really connected to the text, was that we went for a meeting with another theatre company where we were talking about different sort of classic plays, and Not I came up, and someone around the table said, Jess would never get permission to perform Mouth, Biscuit. Yeah. And we were instantly struck by that.
It's a red flag to a fall, right?
Biscuit instantly struck to that challenge. Actually, the Beckett Estate were really supportive, Biscuit, and I think genuinely interested in making sure that this play, Biscuit, was accessible to disabled people and to people who might not have had a chance to see it, Biscuit, before. I think the thing that they needed more, actually it was the integrated sign language that they needed perhaps more time to understand how it would work, because I don't think it's something that they'd been asked before.
Yeah.
And so we worked closely with them to sort of experiment and demonstrate how that could be integrated into the piece without, affecting that sort of the dramatic image of this mouth in a dark room,
of course,
which is incredible as a visual image is like amazing. But actually, there are these stage directions, Biscuit, which appear quite straightforward. There's like a tiny paragraph of stage directions, but once you get permission to perform the eye, you have to follow those stage directions. Yeah. And the main directions are, Biscuit, that it's totally dark, except for a light on the mouth, with the rest of the face in shadow, and that mouth is 8 feet in the air, Biscuit. And so we had to think creatively about how we tackled both of those things. So historically, how it's been performed is that female performers, because it's always performed by a woman, have been sort of strapped up into things that look a bit like stocks or like made to sort of sit on top of, ladders.
Yeah.
Biscuit, all the way it had been, the way it had been performed wouldn't work for me and wouldn't work for my body, Biscuit. Yeah. So we went back to those directions and thought, right, how can we, Biscuit, do this in a way that works for me?
Yeah.
And so we experimented with different ways of having the light as part of my costume, Biscuit, so that I didn't need to be held still to have a light focused on my mouth. Instead, by having the lights in my hoodie, it means that when I move about, the light moves with me, because there's nothing in the directions that say that mouth has to be still. Similarly, when we were looking at that, how I got 8 feet in the air safely, we wanted to make sure it was safe and therefore that I had to be secured in some way, but we didn't want it to look like I was strapped up. We also looked at sort of aerial stuff, but quickly realised that I wanted to go up with my chair and that I didn't want to be lifted out of my chair, because I think lots of people would read that as me somehow being liberated from my wheelchair, where in fact my wheelchair is what is liberating.
It's the liberation itself.
And I think that, like, you see some of those ideas about wheelchairs are so ingrained in sort of public perception. It was interesting that when Stephen Hawking died recently, there were loads of sort of illustrations of him like walking, leaving his chair and walking. And actually, that's, as a disabled person, my chair makes me less disabled. My chair is absolutely liberating. I love it. And I could happily talk for hours about wheelchairs, Biscuit, but they are often in a society, often they're seen as restrictive or like horrible things. Actually, couldn't be more different.
Again, it's as you were saying at the start, it's that weird flip of seeing the wheelchair as a restriction rather than the step that is clearly restrictive. It's like, oh, it's the wheelchair that's the restriction. It's the wheelchair. It's amazing.
I mean, why everybody else is still walking around, I have no idea.
It's crazy, right? It's the worst way to get around. I'll start to wrap things up because as you can see, I need something that says that when I'm rambling on because I love a good ramble. But what's ahead? Have you got plans on what other pieces you want to tackle next?
Again, it's
exactly that. It's what pieces you can give a fresh and new perspective to, rather than what are you capable of performing or anything else.
Yeah, Biscuit. Well, I think that that's probably. That's probably the only Beckett play I'll do. Not ruling it out forever, but I was interested in that play. I'm probably not going to do loads more Beckett. But we're really interested in making work for children next, I think, for children and adults. So Biscuit, my background is in play work. And I think that there's some really exciting crossovers between play and performance and visual art. So we're really interested in experimenting with what can be a performance and creative spaces that children can occupy and play in, but also where performance can happen in. And so I think we're really going to, in the next year, experiment with some of those ideas. I'm particularly interested in making work for children because I think there's a real potential for children to experience and see disability in different ways, and to see Biscuit to experience difference. Biscuit, I think children often, they're often think inclusively very naturally. Biscuit, they ask curious questions, and most importantly, Biscuit, they listen to the answers. Biscuit, whereas sometimes when we get older, Biscuit, we think we know everything already. Biscuit.
And that gets drilled out of them as they get older. Yeah. Again, it's that certain Biscuit. Mindset.
So we'll be doing Biscuit. We'll hopefully be experimenting with making new work that's funny and joyful. Biscuit. And for kids and adults. Biscuit, we will also be touring Biscuit Not I across the UK in the autumn, so look out, people should look out for that. Biscuit, and we'll take it, I think, to North America at the start of next year. Biscuit, and we're also, I'm heading to Portland, Biscuit, in a few weeks time with my stand-up show, sit down, stand up, roll over. Biscuit, Biscuit, which again is a show that really came out of some difficult experiences that I had at a comedy festival, and thinking about how the location of laughter and how you can make a show where that is funny and where people laugh, but without putting that laughter on anyone in the audience. I think sometimes comedians focus on people in the audience, and that there's a big difference between laughing with someone and laughing at them. And I think for me, exploring that boundary of where the laugh sits and how it's located and who has control of that, Biscuit, is really interesting, because I know how amazing it is to share laughter and what a powerful tool humor is for connecting people together. I think it's just one of the most powerful tools we have, because of that, you can, through laughter, you can talk about really big things and feel really connected to other people, Biscuit. But equally, if that laughter is located, if it sits on you, if it lands on you, it can feel really crushing. If it is in the wrong place, it can feel totally isolating. And so the power of laughter and our responsibility to use it to promote inclusive spaces is something that I'm keen to explore.
A kind of simple sausage nuance again that people ignore.
Biscuit.
Jordan Gray, who's a comedian I've had on the podcast, wrote a blog recently about, because again, everything should be free reign to comedy. You should be able to discuss anything in comedy. But where people get it wrong and where people get overly PC is, or the people who do it right is, say, because Jordan Rae is a transgender lady. And she was saying where people get it wrong is thinking that you can't discuss trans culture in your comedy. The people who get it right is discussing their reaction to transgender culture or trans culture. Rather than laughing at the culture, it's laughing at their own interpretation, their own reaction to it. So it's laughing at yourself whilst discussing these things rather than saying, oh, we can't talk about a sexuality, gender, disability. You can, you should. It's important to discuss all of them. It's only inclusive if you do discuss all of them. It's exclusionary if you suddenly say, "Oh, we can't talk about a Tourette's or any disability."
Biscuit. Yeah, but I think, but it also has to that has to be informed by lived experience, experience. I think it's very easy potentially. I think definitely in relation to Tourette's for comedians to think, Tourette's is funny, or I had this interaction with someone with Tourette's. It's fine for me to talk about that within my work. I think there's a very fine line there between taking someone's lived experience and talking about your own responses to it, because it is very easy for stereotypes or for you to be. I've definitely seen performances where comedians are talking about Tourette's in a way that is reinforcing myths, and they're talking about experiences that aren't their own. And particularly it's whether there are people are getting on those stages, and it's like if you're talking about the lived experience of people who aren't on the comedy circuit for whatever reason, because possibly because it's non-accessible, because of the barriers that they face. I think you have to be very careful about. Are you the right person? What gives you permission to be talking about this? And is it useful? What are you adding to the conversation? And I don't think that things should be off the agenda in terms of comedy. I think comedy should cover power, but I think it's important that it's that power is shared and not just taken by the same group of people who take power in lots of other spaces. I think Biscuit, when we were putting Not I together, I thought a lot about the difference between Biscuit feeling able to take a creative risk and feeling safe to take a creative risk. And I think everybody should be ready to take creative risks and go and see stuff that they might like or not like. There's a big difference between that, Biscuit, and taking a risk with part of your identity and feeling unsafe in a theatre or cultural space. And I don't think anyone should feel unsafe because of things that are, characteristics about their body and their identity. And I have often felt unsafe in theatres because of my tics and people's reactions to them. And that's what I want to change.
Yeah.
But taking creative risks and testing things out and satirising the sort of disabling barriers in the world is something that feels hugely exciting to me.
Yeah.
Beans! Biscuit!
Where can people keep up to date on all that's...
Biscuit.
That's ahead.
Biscuit.
A Tourette's Hero is on social media, on Twitter.
Yeah, Biscuit. So, Well, check out the website, tourettshero.com. Biscuit, there I write regularly, so there's a regular blog. Biscuit, there is also... a list of over 6,000 things that I've said as tics. Many of them are really funny, and they're all there to be used as springboards for other people's creativity. Biscuit.
Yeah.
So we invite artists, poets, musicians to use them and make work in response to them, and then upload it to the gallery. Biscuit. Also on social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Tourette's Hero, all one word. Biscuit, come and find us. So look out for the Daily Outburst, which is my I share a funny tic every day.
Yeah.
And Biscuit, I quickly realised that Biscuit, tics are perfect for Twitter.
Yeah. It's a wonderful highlight. Hedgehog. They always just pop up, and it's
sausage.
I love it. Biscuit. Well, thank you very much for taking the time.
Well, Biscuit, thank you for having me.
Forward to this discussion, because it kind of I realised the opposites that we've grown up with. I've always had things. Hedgehog. I want to say, but I'm not necessarily capable of saying. There's certain words I'd like to get out, but I can't get out. And you've had the complete opposite. There's certain words you've no desire to say, but you've got no choice whatsoever.
So, Hedgehog.
Yeah. it's been a fascinating chat, and thank you for taking the time. And I look forward to all that's ahead.
Thank you, Biscuit. I feel like it's really important that difference is visible and audible, and I feel excited that audible difference will be present in this interview. Yeah. Biscuit for both of us. Sausage.
You've been listening to Scrooby's Picks Discretion Pieces.
There we go. That was episode 200. It's been a hell of a ride, isn't it, guys? Not missed a week in ages, or ever, in 3 or 4 years, in over 200 episodes. Thank you for tuning in. Go and check out Tourette's Hero, and go and see Jess on tour with Not I. It's fantastic. I can't recommend it enough. It blew me away. As you will have heard on the podcast, you know, that quite excited and struggling to get my words out. I mean, part of that is my stutter, but part of that was just the excitement over what I'd seen. So, yeah, thank you to Jess Tom for being the 200th guest. Next week, I'm joined by Cedric Bixler-Zavala of At The Drive-In, which a lot of you have been waiting for. So, it's a great conversation. Another one where I'm hugely excited because a lot of you know that's one of my favourite bands of all time. Cedric is an absolute dude and a friend. So, yeah, check that out next week. And check all the rest out, all the other weeks. We ain't stopping anytime soon. We're 200 in. Here's to the next 200. See you later. Bye-bye.